Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. I'm Patrick Gray. On this week's program, we are chatting with hacker superstar and YouTube phenomenon, Sammy Kamkar. Sammy is a security researcher of note. His recent hardware hacks have been coming thick and fast. This week, I spoke to him about his brush with the law following his unleashing of the Sammy worm on MySpace a decade ago. And I also spoke to him about some of his current research and his plans for the future. This week's show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security. Big thanks to Tenable for its support of the Risky Business podcast. We sure do appreciate it. And in this week's sponsor interview, we're speaking with Tenable's very own Chris Thomas, aka Space Rogue. He was one of the early Loft crew, and this week we get his thoughts on the encroachment of security into pop culture and mainstream media. Between the Ashley Madison data breach's media impact and the fantastic USA Network television program, Mr. Robot, is the security community finally getting the love it has been craving all of these lonely, lonely years? Space Rogue joins us for that chat soon. And what a week at Risky Business HQ. Wired.com published a list of 12 must-follow security feeds earlier this week, and this podcast was on the list, which also included the Twitter account of the United States Ambassador to the United Nations, WikiLeaks, and indeed this week's guest, Sammy Kamkar, also swift on security, can't forget about that. About Risky Business, Wired wrote, "The security industry's most informative podcast, hosted weekly by Australian Patrick Gray, offers a news roundup with the right blend of snark and insight from top InfoSec pros." Geez, what can I say? Thanks, guys. So I imagine we might have a few first-time listeners this week. A big welcome to you. And what do I have to say about this recognition? Well,
I'm kind of a big deal. People know me. I'm very important. I have many leather-bound books, and my apartment smells of rich mahogany.
I couldn't resist throwing that in there. Okay, we'll get to those interviews a bit later on, but first up, as always, it is time for a check of the week's security news headlines with our good pal, Insomnia Security's very own Adam Boileau, who joins us each week from Wellington, New Zealand, for his take on the news. And Adam, for the third week in a row, we're going to start off the news with the fallout from the Ashley Madison data breach. Last week, we spoke about a piece that Brian Krebs had written up for Krebs on Security, in which he'd identified a Twitter account he thought was linked to the attack. It looks a little bit more complicated now.
Yeah, it certainly does. I guess, you know, doing attribution is very hard, as anyone who's done incident response knows, and doing attribution purely from public sources is extra so. Certainly, when we talked about it last week, I mean, it, you know, the behavior of the Twitter account, the Status Zoo Twitter account, did seem a little strange.
Yeah, like we should explain that Brian had identified a Twitter account that appeared to be well ahead of the media in terms of understanding what was about to happen in the Ashley Madison case. This account had over 100,000 tweets, which really, when you read them, didn't make a lot of sense. Now, after he published his story, and indeed after we did the podcast last week, I actually got in touch with Brian, and he was very kind in passing on to me the archive of those tweets that he'd manually gone through and saved. It took him hours, right? So he sent them over to me, and I started grepping through them. And based on an idea that was posted in one of the comments on Krebs on Security, that this was actually a chat channel, this Twitter account was actually a chat channel, I started grepping through it. I spent hours grepping through it, and I managed to identify about 11 distinct handles. This Twitter account is, in fact, a multi-user chat channel for a group of people. It's fascinating.
It does seem a little nonsensical, doesn't it? I mean, but you're right. That's what the data seems to read like. But why exactly anyone want to do that, I'm not quite sure.
Well, there are some chat, you know, Web 2.0 chat sort of things that have web options. So you could publish, you know, the content of your channel online so that people can read it. So the only bit of data missing from this Twitter account is like who is actually sending the tweets, right? If you ignore that that information is missing, it all makes perfect sense. I pulled out a bunch of handles. There's Amigo, Hombre, Bro, Man, Redneck, Shadow, Freak, Huss, Krieg, Doc, and Viking, right? So it was really interesting just sitting there with Grep and just going through and, you know, trying to figure it out together. Whether or not this group of people had anything to to do with the Ashley Madison hack, anything to do with that, I'm not entirely sure. But the Register is carrying a piece that is trying to sort of debunk Krebs' work, but conveniently ignores some of the smokier guns, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, certainly a lot of heavy weather is made of the attribution on the basis of listening to AC/DC, which, you know, probably isn't the smallest group of people in the world. It's not even good AC/DC. It's like Thunderstruck, which is well
overused AC/DC. I know. What's
AC/DC?
With the Brian Johnson AC/DC, man? It's Bon Scott all the way. Come
well,
on.
I concur, obviously, being a, you know, dyed-in-the-wool bogan myself. I have opinions about these things, but no, it does makes heavy weather of that without really addressing some of the other interesting bits, as you say, all of the interaction between the various people who are using this channel. But yeah, it's all very strange. And as to whether, as you say, whether it ties into Ashley Madison, and the Register piece does make some good points about timelining, you know, only using one source, only using Twitter, you know, when some of this information was available in other mediums in a way that would be before in time it was being talked about by Desu. So it's hard to say, and I don't know. I guess some people are looking into it, and people who are investigating, people who are after the $500,000 bounty, I'm sure, are interested in looking. But you know, it will continue to unfurl. Maybe we'll see. Maybe we'll see something else come out. Maybe it is indeed, as the Register suggests, a U.S. Army counter-intel operation.
Well, you never know. You just never know. Now, Brian's been copping a bit of static over this because, you know, I mean, fundamentally, the piece did miss that aspect of this Twitter account, right? And there were a few things that Brian wasn't 100% spot on about, but it was still, you know, very good work. And it'll be really interesting to watch what shakes out of this in the future. Meanwhile, Ashley Madison itself says, hey, you know, business is great. We've just added over 100,000 users in the last week. But, you know, you've got to take this news with a grain of salt, don't you? Because if their mail spools have proved anything, it's that they're not entirely an honest organization, you have to say.
Yeah, well, exactly, yes. Now, they put out a press release saying that everything is fine. They have 100,000 new users. Something like 2.8 million women have used the messaging feature on the site, rather than the 2.8 million out of the 1,200 actual women on the site have apparently sent messages. I'm sure that's unrelated to scripting. But no, they claim everything is fine, and I'm sure they're looking for someone to buy them in a hurry.
Anyway, moving on. And Charlie Miller and Chris Valasek, of course, have been generating headlines for years now by hacking the automobiles. And Uber has hired them to go and work for them, which is fascinating news, especially considering Uber is in the race to build self-driving cars. You know, in the race against Google to actually get the self-driving cars happening, because, of course, you know, that would be a very fortunate thing for their business model.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's I imagine they must have paid some fairly serious cash for it too. I'm sure after the Black Hat, most recent Black Hat performance, Chris and Charlie must be in quite a lot of demand as a pair. Because previously Charlie Miller was Twitter and Chris Valasek was at IO Active, and I imagine both of those companies have supported their research and now are waving goodbye to them. I wonder how they feel about that. But Uber has snapped them up, and they're going to be working on securing vehicles for Uber's fleet, and yes, onwards into the self-driving car story. I saw actually someone pasted an image around the couple of ISC channels this week of a project, I think it's a Land Rover in the UK, to build like externally drivable Land Rovers so that you can use your iPhone to get out and then look and drive your car from the outside so you can see what things you're trying to four-wheel drive over. And I imagine that that's a thing that all of the aspiring car hackers around the place are salivating over. So yeah, it's very much time for this to get real attention. And clearly Uber is going to make the most of it for the period that they retain the services of this pair.
As someone who four-wheel drives occasionally, I can tell you that would actually be very, very useful. But yes, it is a bit of a I reckon the odds are against them having done that right. Comes up in this week's sponsor interview with Space Rogue. We talk about the old Land Rover remote control app. That is coming up later, of course. Ars Technica, meanwhile, is carrying a write-up of some research by Palo Alto Networks, which is showing that there are attacks, meaningful, organized attacks, against jailbroken iPhones, because there are a lot of jailbroken iPhones in China. So there is actually there are targets out there to be had this way. They found something like 225,000 Apple IDs and passwords that had been collected using this malware.
Yeah, this is malware that's being distributed through the Cydia kind of third-party app store, app market thing, repository that you get when you typically jailbreak your iPhone in a way that installs it. And yeah, this is obviously much more common outside of the, you know, more carrier controlled markets in the West. But yeah, 200,000, you know, quarter of a million Apple IDs, that's a pretty substantial haul. And you could make some, you know, pretty real money with that, I'm sure. But yeah, I was surprised actually at the scale. You know, that attacking jailbroken iPhones was such a useful thing. But yeah, I guess I don't consider it in the context of other markets.
Yeah, I mean, how you actually monetize those login pairs. I remember seeing a talk, I think it was many years ago actually at KiwiCon, which was about how you could play funny tricks with the App Store and trick people into buying ludicrously expensive apps. But the invoicing cycles for the App Store are so long that chances are your developer account's going to be yanked by the time the money hits your account. So yeah, I'm not quite sure what you can do with that, but obviously someone's figured something out, because otherwise they wouldn't be doing all of that work to collect the accounts.
Yeah, of course, the hilarious coda to this particular story is that the command and control infrastructure for this particular malware had SQL injection in its control panel, and other people have been stealing the data from it. So
yes, which is that's right. Nothing like a bit of parasitic CNC jacking, you know? We like that. Nice. Why do it yourself when you can just steal it from those who've done the risky part?
Yes, nice segue to the US government. Carry on.
Well, yes, and there's been a whole bunch of news items doing the rounds, which claim that you know, various spy services around the world have been using the OPM data to actually identify spies. You know, based in embassies, because of course, you know, state government personnel were present in the OPM leak. CIA agents were not, so that would have made it fairly trivial to identify CIA agents based in you know, based in embassies around the world. And of course, you know, how long they had that data for? They were able to surveil these people who were identified as agents and round up their assets. So, you know, it looks like there has been some real world impact here.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly this is the obvious use case for this data set. I mean, having HR information about everyone in the government, clearly this is the sort of thing you would do with it. I mean, these stories all seem to tie back to, you know, the typical kind of, you know, unnamed US government sources. So there isn't any, you know, hard data to go on as to exactly what's happening, exactly what data is being correlated, you know, whether it is purely OPM, whether there's other data sources being used. I mean, obviously the media is drawing the connection to Ashley Madison, which, you know, whether or not that's a useful thing, I don't know. That just seems like, you know, kind of headline work. But it is a bit fluffy, but this is what you would do with a data set. So it certainly seems believable, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And it's just a useful reminder that, you know, quite often this stuff actually matters and affects lives, not just people's relationships when they've been on dodgy websites trying to get affairs and not really getting affairs, just talking to bots. I mean, how's that, man? You know, can you imagine your marriage dissolving because you like paid $20 to talk to a bot?
Truly the dystopian cyberpunk future.
It truly, truly is. Lizard Squad, back in the news. They've been launching DDoS attacks, one against a UK law enforcement agency, the National Crime Authority. They went down for 2 hours. So these guys, I mean, I'm really surprised they're not in a box by now.
Yeah, I mean, clearly if you come out and, you know, flip the bird or flip the lizard, I guess, in this case, against, you know, law enforcement who are taking down customers of your service, that's you know, you're just waving a red flag in front of them, aren't you? I mean, and they're going to...
So, yeah, a little bit of come at me, bro, there, right?
Well, exactly. That's exactly what's going on. And you know, in some ways it has echoes of LulzSec. So maybe, in fact, Lizard Squad is an undercover FBI operation. Who knows?
Who knows indeed. Staying with DDoS crews now, and DD4BC, which actually took down risky.biz for a little while. So I've got a bit of skin in the game on this one. They're an extremely prolific DDoS crew or DDoS actor, but apparently the heat is really on them now. There's a whole bunch of people getting together to try to track the perpetrator down. It'll be interesting to see what they come up with.
Yeah, I mean, I think this group really has, you know,
pissed off a lot of people.
Yeah, a lot of noses have been tweaked by this particular crew, and they certainly rolled through Australia and New Zealand, threatening to DDoS people for, you know, relatively small amounts of Bitcoin, although it does appear from looking at the Bitcoin trail that they aren't making a lot of money out of it so far. But yeah, they've tweaked a lot of noses, and there's a lot of people trying to figure out exactly who it is, and, you know, maybe we will see them pay for it.
Well, maybe we won't. You know, it's about time you know, as much as I loathe these guys, it's about time we actually saw some competent cyber criminals out there thumbing their noses and actually getting away with it by practicing good OPSEC and using the right tools. You know, there's still that part of me that wants to see people actually get away with something.
Well, we don't know who did Hacking Team yet, do we? But no, people, you know, you're right. I mean, obviously, good OPSEC in the criminal underworld or in this kind of, you know, cybercrime that's making real money, you know, is a thing they will gradually learn. You know, the Grok's doing his best to educate people. And, you know, eventually, they will learn. But yeah, for now, we'll have to wait and see whether he's got a, you know, Ross Ulbricht style diary of his, you know, thoughts and feelings about committing cybercrime.
A couple of weeks ago, the Grok was actually on the show filling in for you, and we spoke about this BitTorrent reflection DDoS technique. It seems that BitTorrent, they've kind of patched it or moved to rate limit it.
Yeah, so this was the bug where you could essentially solicit multiple responses by adjusting your TCP window. It's quite a clever idea, actually. But no, it's been patched in the particular implementations that were vulnerable to it without it apparently being used in any large scale. But yeah, it was quite an interesting bug. I missed it, of course, because I was away.
Have they fixed it or partially mitigated it?
It's fixed in that it's not the amount of data that's being reflected through it.
Sort of makes it useless.
Down.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so it reduces the amplification factor by adjusting the window size of the amount of data that can be in flight at any point in time, which is an effective mitigation, really.
Yeah, cool. We'll just see if it breaks stuff, like a whole bunch of clients.
You know? Yeah, well, no. Possible, yeah.
Yeah. Now, a former intern at FireEye has actually admitted to developing some Android spyware, which is, probably not so great for the career.
Yeah, as a university student who spent, 4 months working at FireEye, and during that period had been writing and selling Android malware, actually quite a sophisticated piece of Android malware, according to the report.
Well, he was a professional.
well, clearly, yes. But no, he was selling it for, you know, the princely sum of $300 a pop on Darkcode, which, you know, you would think that a career is probably worth more than, you know, 100 copies of a $300 piece of malware. But
dude, it was a long time since you were a student, I'm guessing, man. Because I remember, you know, when I was at university, buying a can of Coke was a major life decision. You know what I mean? That was something I had to budget for. So I kind of get it. You know, you got to wonder how much he was getting paid as an intern as well.
Well, yeah, clearly. Maybe FireEye should think about that. Not encourage criminals by underpaying them.
Staying with Android, and there's a bit of malware going around that uses XMPP for callback, which I guess, you know, makes a lot of sense. I'm surprised that's not, you know, more malware actually doing that. But it claims that it's from the NSA, this malware. It claims this is NSA stuff and you have to pay us money because we're defending your freedoms or something.
Yes, and you have to pay the NSA through a PayPal My Cash card, and only that way, because there is no other way that the US government can take money for its protection services.
Seems legit.
Yeah.
Is there anything decent here, or is it just, you know, usual sort of scareware, you know, pay us now stuff?
It's pretty much usual scareware. I mean, obviously the use of XMPP for a transport is sort of medium interesting,
I guess. Pretty heavy protocol for callbacks, though, because I know a little bit about XMPP due to the invisible IM stuff, and it's pretty gnarly.
Well, sure, but I guess on the wire it looks legit, and you can transport crypto and kind of forget about it being blocked. And of course, it's indirect. Of course, you can go via servers rather than direct to where your final destination. So that's kind of useful in preventing network layer defenses. But we've seen chat protocols. I mean, IRC, of course, is the traditional command and control mechanism for you know, Unix botnets and things. So
Do people still use IRC? People are so used to looking for it that it just sort of sticks out like dog's balls on the wire, you know?
I use IRC. Does that count? But no, whether people use it for command and control, you would imagine it has fallen out of favor. But you go rummage around a public network, you'll probably find something interesting.
Yeah, or a university network. Got to start somewhere. Baby's first callback. OPM has spent $133 million on credit monitoring, according to Brian Krebs. And, you know, for first-time listeners, there are a few of you, I'd imagine, this week. This is sort of a running gag in the show, is that every time there's a major breach, which has nothing to do with your credit details, the affected organization, usually its way of making things good is to buy you credit monitoring.
And it's not even the good credit monitoring. It's just like the cheap, we'll just monitor. We don't actually do the thing that really helps, which Brian describes as, you know, freezing your credit so you can't actually get a mortgage in your name without, you know, at least talking to you a little bit rather than, you know, doing it online or whatever. But no, $133 million worth of free credit monitoring when, five stories ago we talked about the data being used to correlate and find CIA agents and embassies, right?
That's really fixing the problem. At least once they've been abducted in a van, right, and they're being tortured in the bunker, they don't have to worry about their house being refinanced.
That's very true. That's always glass half full, Pat.
That's right. Another story from Ars now, and the White House. This one has been doing the rounds, I should say, among a number of services. But the White House is actually looking at imposing sanctions on China over, you know, theft of trade secrets, blah, blah, blah. This is a story that we have seen published, you know, a few times a year for the last 5 years. And it never seems to happen, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, this is it's saber rattling and well, it's not even really saber rattling. It's sort of stick rattling, maybe. And it goes
letter opener rattling.
Yeah, exactly. They're writing stern letters to the editor, deploring China's actions in economic espionage. Although I suppose Donald Trump gets into power, then there was this video during the rounds on YouTube of him saying China for 3 minutes solid. Like someone to cut together every time he said China. So maybe he takes China seriously, and you should all vote for him, Americans. But
maybe,
the real question,
maybe he'll get them to build a wall, like a firewall, and they have to pay for it. Oh, wait, they already have. this guy. Am I right?
the only real question I had about this article on Ars, it's illustrated by a number of Chinese military gentlemen sitting in front of their terminals, you know, committing cybercrime or hacking or defending their country, whatever it is they're doing. They're wearing helmets.
They are wearing helmets.
Like bulletproof metal helmets whilst sitting in front of their, you know, like...
Well, you know, when the Ant catalog dropped from the NSA, we did see that they had some pretty amazing techniques. I mean, maybe they've got some form of weaponized packet that could brain you. I don't know.
That's true. Maybe they can turn your computer into a bomb.
Maybe they can. I think there's been a few stories on that over the years as well.
Yes, indeed. anyway.
Now, trouble in Turkey, and something to keep in mind if you're traveling to Turkey, is a bunch of Vice News journalists have been arrested over there and charged with terrorism offences due to the presence of, quote, sophisticated encryption software on their laptops. Now, this is stuff that is apparently favoured by Islamic State and various jihadi groups, but they seem to have been charged for nothing more than possessing this software, which is, you know, whoa.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of concerning. I mean, obviously, any laptop is perfectly capable of carrying out encryption these days. You don't need specific software. But regardless of that, you know, having, you know, being arrested for having a piece of software that, you know, especially as a journalist, when you're presumably interviewing sources, talking to people, getting, you know, collecting the news, you're going to do it via whatever mechanism people want to talk to you through. And if that's jihadi branded, you know, rubbish IM tools, then so be it. But no, it's not good. And I guess, yeah, if you're planning on traveling to Turkey, that would be a thing you'd want to consider.
Yeah, and, you know, it certainly is making the news, and I think there will be a pretty big response to this. I mean, we saw what happened with Peter Grester arrested in Egypt. You know, he worked for Al Jazeera, an Australian guy. That was a big deal. You know, he's just been – he got deported eventually. He did about a year in prison, got deported, and then they've since resentenced him in absentia to 3 years, and some of his colleagues are in prison. So, you know, we're seeing this sort of thing happen, and it's pretty awful. I mean, it's clearly just designed to send a clear message to foreign press to stay out. So that's why they're doing it. Whether or not they get away with it, we'll just have to wait and see. I've also included a link to a bunch of notes the Grok has written on this note is titled "The Jihadist Fan Club Crypto Crap." And it's really about, you know, this type of software and how it's actually, you know, people use it to identify with a particular sort of brand. So he says, using some of these tools, it's sort of like wearing a sports team jersey. It's an interesting read. Click through to this week's show notes to have a look at that. Krebs has also reported, this one's a fascinating stat. We had him on the show about a month ago talking about these email scams where you basically just send an email saying, "Hey, Nancy, can you please transfer $2 million to our supplier in China? Here are the details." And it's staggering how often that works. The FBI has now put a dollar figure on it, and they're saying it has cost the United States $750 million between October 2013 and August this year, which is just amazing.
It is. It's a staggering amount of money. I mean, certainly, you know, I would have expected tens of millions. We heard that story about, was it Ubiquity Networks, you know, losing $40 million or something. But $750 million, and including overseas victims, the FBI is saying $1.2 billion in this kind of fraud. Like, that's very real cash.
Sure.
For an attack that really is quite, you know, quite straightforward. I mean, in terms of, you know, if you compare it to the traditional malware, the traditional phishing, traditional, you know, spamming, things that cyber criminals have done to make money. This is an attack that's essentially lower sophistication.
It is.
And clearly is making probably better cash, actually. And you would expect we're going to see a real uptick. You know, if you're a cyber criminal and you saw those numbers, you'd be like, well, why don't I have a piece of that?
Yeah, well, I mean, even if you're not a criminal, I got to say. But, you know, all you need is Tor and access to a vulnerable mail server. And, you know, the finance side of it would be the trickiest part, is actually getting the cash out. But holy God, you know, if you could just email someone and say, hey, fling us a couple of million, and they do, you know, that is a very tempting scam. And I think really, you know, we like to focus on the more exotic threats, but something like this, in terms of how it's going to impact the enterprise, if this is truly a growing crime type, I think it's going to have some pretty serious ramifications for the way companies do business.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I mean, this is a low-tech, high-effectiveness attack, and why wouldn't you do it? If you're a Nigerian, you know, traditionally a Nigerian 419 scammer, you've got all the necessary skills. And this is clearly going to work better than you know, trying to fish lonely people, you know, to money mule imaginary amounts of money around for you for advanced fraud, advanced fee fraud. Like, that makes no sense. This makes a whole bunch more.
Yeah, please send money. Okay.
Yeah, exactly, right? You don't have to string them on for 6 months building a relationship. You just say, I'm the boss. You will send money to China.
Yeah. Yeah, works out all right. Now, here's a funny one you sent me this week. We've often heard that if you accidentally publish your Amazon Web Services keys, you know, in a code repo on GitHub, there are that many bots out there that it will be pulled out within about 5 seconds and used to spin up like a zillion EC2 instances that will mine Bitcoins, right? Like, that is a thing. But even when you're actually taking steps to make sure that doesn't happen, doesn't always go your way, as we can illustrate with this lovely anecdote, Adam.
There's this blog post where the guy explains his experience being billed something like $6,500 worth of Amazon time because he checked his private keys into GitHub. Now, you might be thinking,
what an idiot.
Stupid DevOps developers, they do this every day. That's just how they roll, you know, situation normal. No, this guy is using Visual Studio, and he's using the some of the new GitHub plugins that Microsoft provide for Visual Studio, and he explicitly clicked the box that says, I would like this code to be checked into a private repository. Guy had a paid account on GitHub, had made private repositories, you know, knows what he's doing. Clicked private repository, Visual Studio made it public.
Yep.
Yet.
And he confirmed it as a bug too. Like, this isn't a one-time thing.
Confirmed bug. Oh dear.
Yeah. Thankfully, it looks like Amazon are writing off the charge, but it's like, come on, Microsoft. That's like, that's a pretty awful mistake. So we got to hope that they patch that. I want to talk about a piece now from The Register, which actually has what I think to be some pretty serious consequences. It's a lawsuit. The Associated Press is suing the FBI because the FBI actually used a fake Associated Press news article to spearfish a suspect in a like high school bomb hoax threat, like some 15-year-old kid. Now, the reason AP is, and this happened in like 2007, the reason Associated Press are suing is because, you know, they're saying, hey, FBI, you're sort of undermining our credibility as a news organization. You're appropriating our brand, turning it into an attack. That's going to make people scared of our content. The reason this is such an interesting case is because if we look at Stuxnet and we look at the certificate chaining attack that the, you know, US and Israelis ran against Microsoft to be able to have their payload signed so that it would bypass detections, similar legal issues, right? Which is you're actually appropriating the trust inherent in a brand. In the case of Stuxnet, it was Microsoft's brand. In the case of this FBI spear phishing attempt, it was the Associated Press brand. This is going to court, and the implications could be quite huge. Adam.
Yeah, it is. And it's a really interesting case for exactly the reasons that you describe. I mean, as a, you know, watering hole attacks and attacks that rely on luring people to visit things that they believe are trustworthy, you know, are a tool that's, you know, well used in the hacker tool chain. We saw, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I think we talked about EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, you know, having a fake EFF site being set up, presumably by the Russian government, to, you know, lure, you know, and own people who are trying to download or use their tools. So, I mean, this is a thing that absolutely does happen. But it is different when it's a government or law enforcement, you know, officially doing this. I mean, certainly I am surprised we didn't see more fallout of, you know, FBI and Lulzsec versus Stratfor. You know, slightly different case in that, you know, the FBI kind of allowed Stratfor to get hacked on their watch. But similar sort of issue. And, yeah, this is a case that potentially could be really interesting. Well, what would they do if a ruling came back and said, no, you can't do that?
You know, I think AP have a point here. And I think Microsoft would have had a point if they challenged the NSA over the certificate chaining issue that led to Stuxnet being signed by Microsoft. You know, this is, of course, the only reason I came to think about this at all is because Kim Zetter's book, Stuxnet Countdown to Zero Day, really looks at that Microsoft issue. And, you know, she spoke to a few lawyers about it. It was all very interesting stuff. But you can read a link to that. You can read that piece. It is linked to in this week's show notes. Going to move on to some tool releases now. Next, Netflix has released a tool called Sleepy Puppy, which looks for cross-site scripting vulnerabilities in secondary applications. Is this something that's going to be useful?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, this is a tool that basically will generate unique XSS payloads for stored cross-site scripting, which then when they get activated in the future, call back to some listening point to say, hey, I got triggered. But because they're unique and you can stick them in, you know, you might get the callback 6 months later after some particular piece of data has wormed its way from, you know, one system to, you know, another to another to another, and eventually got to somewhere where it isn't correctly processed. And that's a class of bug that the sort of pen testing tools that we currently use don't really deal with. I mean, kind of, you know, first and second order reflected cross-site scripting or persistent cross-site scripting is a thing that we, you know, we look for. But, you know, this kind of long game cross-site scripting, you know, is also a very real way of doing it. And there hasn't really been tools other than hand-rolled stuff for doing that. So I think, yeah, if you're a pen tester or if you're an in-house pen tester, this is probably more useful for in-house people than it is for external consultants, you know, like me. But certainly is worth reading.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm a huge fan of organizations that actually take their in-house expertise, you know, tool it up, you know, use stuff internally and then say, here you go, world, you use this as well. Also, Yahoo has released a couple of tools, which is kind of funny because we love, you know, they're the child we like to kick, really, on the show. They've released a tool called Secure Cross-Site Scripting Filters. They've released another one called Secure Handlebars. These also worthwhile? And they're also running a bug bounty on these things too.
Yeah, so these are tools for doing output encoding when you're templating, when you're generating HTML or JavaScript output, if you're writing stuff in JavaScript, so for people who are running Node.js on the server side or doing this in the client. So these are useful frameworks. I mean, some of the other options from, you know, OWASP or whatever haven't really aged very well. Mm. And, you know, something that is mature and usable and understands, you know, the appropriate context sensitivity for how you should escape things, you know, that's much more complicated than the, you know, some of the older libraries and things that that people use. So yeah, if you're a JavaScript developer, I think it's a thing that's worth looking at. And yes, there are bug bounties, so if you want to go get some cash, you might be able to find some bugs. And there will inevitably be bugs. I mean, this kind of escaping is super fiddly to get right in all of the necessary areas, especially with the browser quirks and anyway everything else that you have to worry about. So yes, go find some bugs, get cash money.
Meanwhile, Apple is having a bit of trouble with the old keychain there.
Yeah, there's been some malware that's doing the rounds at the moment on the Mac platform, which pulls an interesting trick, which apparently actually isn't a new trick, although I hadn't realized this was a thing.
Yeah, it's been around since 2011, right? Like, it's like, who knew?
So this is a trick where when the app is going to go and ask you for, you know, elevated access, like, for example, accessing things in your keychain, it can use the assistive APIs, the things that you use to, you know, do screen reading and, you know, input for people who are vision impaired or whatever. It uses the APIs for this to, like, actually find the window that has the, do you want to allow this program access to your keychain? Yes, no. Find the window, find the button in the window, and then click on it. In like Apple script or in code, which is I'm surprised that actually works. I mean, this is the exact reason why on every Windows box since 95 you have to press Control Alt Del to get to the login window, because the login window and that process runs on a separate Win station and it's isolated, so you can't do this kind of thing. It's exactly why you press Control Alt Delete, why it's a magic keystroke on Windows. And I am surprised that Apple didn't think, well, why do you press Control Alt Del on Windows? Think about it. Oh, maybe we should think about having, you know, trusted input windows. Even X11 has it doesn't work, but even X11 has had this concept, you know, since the 80s. So I'm surprised this is a thing that Apple is falling for, but apparently it is. So
yeah, that'll be interesting. I mean, how does one fix that? But yeah.
Well, I mean, it's kind of architectural, right?
Yeah, that's kind of what I mean, right?
Of marking a particular window as super magical, and then you still have to do it in a way that doesn't break it for people who need those assistive technologies.
So to whoever at Apple has been tasked with fixing that one, you have our deepest sympathies.
It
sucks to be you. But Adam, that's actually it for the week's overly long news segment, mate. Thanks a lot for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, you're most welcome, Pat. I hope you can now that you've finished the new segment, go and recline in your mahogany-scented room, enjoying your leather-bound books.
Oh,
And once you've finished your high roller week off work, I will no doubt talk to you next week.
Adam Bailoa there with a look at the week's security news. And you can find links to everything we talked about in this week's show notes. Go to risky.biz to find them. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Sammy Kamkar. Sammy is a very well-known security researcher who's been in the news lately for some pretty awesome hardware hacks. There's Open Sesame, a device that will open up garage doors with the push of a button. Then there were also some attacks he developed against GM's OnStar app because, hey, locating and remote starting people's cars is fun. It turns out those attacks also applied to BMW and Mercedes-Benz as well. So yeah, he's published vulnerabilities in software as well, and he has a well-earned reputation as one of the smartest guys in the security research field. He's also somewhat of a YouTube celebrity. He does these great videos that teach people about hardware hacking, with many of them racking up crazy amounts of views. I think he averages about 250,000 views per video, but I've seen some doing the rounds, you know, around the 500,000 mark. But Sammy's foray into computer security got off to a somewhat bumpy start. Sammy is also known as the creator of the Sammy Worm. It was the world's first web application worm, and it used cross-site scripting tricks to self-replicate on MySpace. They actually had to pull the whole thing offline to clean it up. It was pretty spectacular and funny, but wound up causing him some grief, which I suppose you shouldn't be too surprised by. I spoke to Sammy via Skype this week about the Sammy Worm and hardware hacking and what he's getting up to. Here's what he had to say.
It was 10 years ago, it was 2005, that I had released this MySpace worm that had essentially infected over 1 million people in about 24 hours. you know, I think there were a couple things that, you know, that were in my favor besides writing a virus. And that was, for one, you know, there was no malicious intent. The virus did two things. Actually, three. It would add people as a friend. So if someone visited my profile, they would add me as a friend. Also, if you visit my profile, you would add me as a hero. So it would add the text, but most of all, Sammy's my hero, to their profile, which I thought was funny at the time as a 19-year-old, and maybe a little bit now. And it would, a third thing it would do is it would actually copy the code that actually it would copy the code from my profile to your profile. So then if someone visited your profile, they would add me as a friend and add me as a hero, and the code would be copied.
So you would have had more MySpace friends than anyone else in the world, except for Tom, of course.
Tom's at the top. But it grew pretty quickly, and I think it was interesting to demonstrate, you know, unintentionally demonstrated, A, how big MySpace is, but, you know, B, also sort of how quickly a worm or virus on the web can actually proliferate.
Yeah, I mean, it was a big lesson, wasn't it, for providers of social networking services to see, you know, what was then the biggest in the world just sort of get burned down overnight. I mean, what was your reaction, though, when you've set this thing out there and you might have been expecting a slow burn or something? Like, were you just sitting there freaking out when you watched what it did?
Yes, exactly. I mean, absolutely. And there's nothing you can do about it, right? Once it's out of your hand, you know, once someone's infected, you can't remove it.
Couldn't you remove your profile?
Sure, but the worm itself would continue to spread, and people would, at the very least, be adding Sammy as my hero to their profile. Mm. So I actually did try to remove my profile, and what happened was, you know, as you suggested, I thought I'd gain like 100 friends in a month, right? I thought it'd be super slow and, you know, mildly entertaining.
Oops.
And I just had no idea. I had no idea. Yeah. Apparently it was the number one website on the internet, according to, I believe it was Alexa at the time. So that was a big surprise. And I think that's what all idiot virus writers say the first time their virus goes out. Oh.
So you flash forward a little while and you wind up getting raided by the Secret Service. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. A couple different agencies came to my house and my company 6 months after the worm. It was the Secret Service, the Electronics Crimes Task Force, the Los Angeles District Attorney, and one or two other agencies or departments. They showed me a search warrant. They went through everything. They took my computer, my laptop, my iPod, anything with data on it. And then they walked away. They just left. It's kind of strange.
So what was the washout of that? I understand you faced a series of, you know, you got convicted for a felony, which you've told me has since been expunged. It was reduced to a misdemeanor and then expunged, which is nice work. But yeah, so you faced a time of probation. You had to do some community service, and you also had to not touch a computer for a period of time. Is that right?
Yeah. So, you know, after they after the Secret Service came, you know, they took all my stuff. And then for about 6 months, I was fighting with the Los Angeles District Attorney, which is interesting because MySpace didn't sue me. So MySpace never actually came after me. It was actually the government. It was just the government. Even though MySpace separately could have performed, you know, civil action and civilly sued me, they did not. It was only the government that came after me for releasing the worm. And after about 6 months, I came to an agreement with them. And the agreement was that that would be zero computer use for the next 3 years, as well as, like you said, probation, some restitution, and community service, a.k.a. picking up trash.
Yeah, painting roadside rocks orange, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Because exactly. They can't give you real work, because then all of a sudden it's, you know, it's competing with actual jobs, right? So you have to do, like, really stupid menial shit.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate because I would have been happy to help in the technology department if I could.
Mm.
And that seemed reasonable to me. I mean, I didn't really have an education to fall back on if they wanted to push that and make that, you know, initially they were talking about making that indefinite in my life, right? No computer use indefinitely. And I thought that wouldn't be great. You know, I dropped out of high school, so I started in technology early on, and I was fortunate that I could, you know, make money from technology. Without a diploma, without even a high school diploma.
Mm.
So I wanted to make sure that I could continue that the rest of my life, if possible. So I agreed that 3 years without computer use. And at the time, I was working at a voice over IP company, so I was just managing a team of engineers at that point. And fortunately, they were doing all the hard work, so it was much easier just to manage them and not necessarily have to do much on the computer.
So basically, you went back to work and said, Charles, read me my inbox.
Yeah, except I didn't have email. Yeah, I didn't have email or anything like that.
So did you wind up spending 3 years without using a computer? Because I went through your Wikipedia entry and like the timeline is a little bit funny there, because it looks like you only did 1 year without using a computer, if that timeline is to be believed.
It was about 3 years. So I think it was like 2006, 7, and 8.
Mm. And what was that like? Because, you know, 2007, of course, was the release of the iPhone, right?
Correct.
So, I mean, there was stuff there that I imagine you would have felt you were really missing out on. I can imagine that for most listeners of this podcast, the idea of doing 3 years without a computer would be horrifying.
You know what? I thought it would be much more difficult. But, you know, even if I personally didn't have computers in my life, like I feel pretty fortunate, you know, period, just to like... in America, there's like plenty of things I could do or go spend my time learning some new skill and going into that totally new industry. So, yeah, it sucked a little bit, but it was okay. I'd say the worst part, the totally worst part of the whole ordeal, after about a week of not having a computer, I got used to it, except for one thing, maps.
Yes.
Google Maps.
Yes.
I'm seriously, it's like if there's anything we take for granted, it's that.
Yeah.
Like going back to a physical piece of paper, it was awful.
Or having to ring up your friend and say, I'm standing at the corner of whatever and whatever. How the hell do I? I mean, yeah. how often did we do that to our poor friends who would be sitting in front? And they had access to Google Maps. Do you know what I mean? This is pre-smartphone era. You would actually ring up your friend and say, hey, can you pull up Google Maps for me?
So. That's pretty funny. And you also brought, you know, the iPhone came out. Now, realize that the iPhone didn't have an app store for a while. So it was kind of when the App Store came out, you know, around that time that I was able to get back into computers.
Hmm. So it's interesting too, because let's go back before the Sammy Worm. You were actually a bit of a teenage entrepreneur in the tech field, right? I mean, why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. So when I was like, when I was 15, I dropped out of high school, not for any good reason. I didn't like it, and I was having way more fun playing Counter-Strike at home. So I just like sit at home. My mom was at work all day. And yeah, I'd play Counter-Strike, but I was also developing open source cheats. So I'd write cheat software on Windows for Counter-Strike, and then I'd release it open source. And at some point, you know, I got some contract remotely and then another contract, and I moved out when I was 16 down to San Diego. And I was working for a pretty cool top-level domain down there for a year or two. And after that, a friend of mine, you know, reached out and said, hey, do you want to start a voice over IP company? And he's like, you know, you want to leave your terrible job and you know, make virtually no money and sleep on my couch. And I was like, no, sounds terrible. I says, well, you know, what do you want to do with your life? And I thought about it. And I was like, man, it'd be really cool to start a company. I'd love to learn how to start a company. And he's like, well, you know what? I sold my last company for $30 million cash. And that was a web hosting company, and I want to start a new one. But, you know, be my co-founder and learn with me.
And you thought $30 million cash? That sounds like an okay idea.
Yeah, and it wasn't even about money. It was more like learning from someone who had been through the ropes. I thought that was the experience that, you know, I would be fortunate to get if anyone else offered, and probably won't. So, yeah, I actually left a really good job in San Diego to sleep on his couch and start a company with him. So I was 17 years old, and I started a company called Phonality with him. It's a voice over IP sort of cloud phone system company. We actually based off of open source software, and we just improved it like to the max. You know, we took this console Linux-based software and made, you know, pretty web interfaces, mobile interface, and made phone systems for businesses easy to use and inexpensive. And that company's, I mean, it's twice as big as since I left it a few, you know, some years ago.
Mm. And were you a shareholder? I mean, you were a co-founder of that company. I mean, did you make it rain is what I'm asking?
I wouldn't say I made it rain. You know, I've made a little bit from it, and you know, I'm still a equity stakeholder there. So.
Yeah.
But
that's pretty groovy.
I'm focusing on other things. So, you know, if something happens to that company, that would be cool for me. But we'll see.
I mean, we'll get to talking about your more current research in a bit, but what is it that you're actually doing, you know, for cash these days? What is your job?
You know, I guess the past 6 years, I've just kind of worked on the stuff that I like, the research that I like, or there's so many areas that I'd love to learn new things. So often I might just work with a company and consult or contract in an area that I'm trying to just gain experience in or trying to be better at. So maybe in the last, you know, year or two, I've been consulting here and there for different companies developing some stuff around hardware because I wanted to learn hardware. Mm. Kind of been afraid of it most of my life. So I thought, you know, when someone expects you to get something done, it's a pretty good motivator. So yeah, I've been consulting for different companies here and there. And a lot of the times I'll do some research in an area and then I'll release it as open source and free. And then someone might come to me and say, hey, we saw your research here. Would you like to develop a more customized version?
Yeah. Can you help it do this?
Exactly. And as long as, you know, I agree with what the company is doing and I think they're doing something good, then I'll do that. A lot of my software, you know, can't really be used for good. A lot of it will just be used for bad. But of course, I'm releasing it so that there can be resolutions to the problems that I see.
Now, I mean, the breadth of your research is pretty spectacular. You've got, you know, you did the most awesome proof of concept JavaScript, you know, cross-site scripting worm ever, the SAMI worm, which was awesome. You did work on web stuff like the whole EverCookie thing. You found bugs in PHP, and now you've moved on to hardware and you just seem to be owning absolutely everything in terms of like GM's OnStar thing and like keyless entry stuff. And what I find interesting is that, you know, the speed with which you've tooled up in this area and with all of the tools that you're releasing, all of these open tools, it makes me wonder whether you think there's going to be any real world impact out of this research, because honestly, it's your stuff and Silvio Cesare's stuff that you've been releasing makes me wonder, like, are we going to start to see thieves walking around with Raspberry Pis jacking people's Beamers and stuff? Like, yes. Are we nearly there?
Absolutely.
Mm.
Oh, I 100% do not doubt this. I started playing with security since I was like 10 years old. Mm. I wasn't good for another 10 years. But from what I've seen from like the past, yeah, it's just like there are patterns. And I believe, you know, what will happen is we will see people with little devices that will be unlocking vehicles, starting vehicles. My proof of concepts are merely, you know, scratching the surface.
Mm. What's the general quality? I mean, when we look at, I got a friend in Melbourne, he's got two really fancy cars. He's got himself a really sweet Lexus. He's got himself a really sweet Mercedes, like both recent model cars. He lets me drive them when I'm in town, which is very, very, very nice. Good of him, right? Because I don't have a car down there or anything. But you know, I've got this keyless entry thing and it was weird to get used to because I drive a couple of old shitters, right? So, you know, I walk up to the car and all of a sudden it just sort of unlocks, you know, when you touch the door handle and then you get in, you press a start button. And, you know, there's a part of me that thinks, gee, I really hope they did this right. Did they, is my question.
I think they've done a lot of things right. And I think that's not enough for a thief. Now, I also think we need to like assess, are thieves really looking to steal high-end vehicles? I'm not sure. Like, maybe it's really hard to take a high-end vehicle to a chop shop. you know, and they also have other areas of security, like, you know, tracking. Like OnStar just tracks your vehicle and where it is. Mm. Although I've demonstrated how you could, like, shut that off or disable that. So, you know, I think one of the things that a lot of these criminals are interested in and that I keep hearing about and people are reaching out to me about is theft, right? If you go to an area that's full of tourists, they're going to have all their stuff in their car, including their, like, laptops and, you know, iPads. And you'll get thousands of dollars of stuff out of a car if you can open it, if you can unlock it and, you know, walk away in a couple minutes.
Yeah, well, I live in basically what is a resort town, and that is a problem here, although people will just generally throw a rock through the window, right?
Yeah. But, you know, if you can do it more covertly or more actually, you know, in broad daylight, then it makes it even easier and you can do it across a much wider range of vehicles.
Oh, your meth head up here will do that in broad daylight. But anyway, they can run fast, man, those meth heads. They really can. But I'm wondering too, like, I mean, you know, what I worry about, you know, if I was you is one day you get the phone call and it's like, Mr. Tagliatucci would like to have lunch with you. You know, have you ever had any shifty approaches like that?
I've had some people come up to me from some, you know, interesting places who've asked me to help them.
Well, I mean, one is organized crime. The other one, of course, is government agencies, which is like they've got some interesting nuts to crack that you would be well suited to crack, like opening various electronic locks and messing with cars and systems like that. I mean, how do you deal with those types of approaches?
I mean, you know, I've never really released. I've never actually, you know, sold any of the stuff that can open something, like unlock something. And you know, if it's a group or agency or something that I actually believe in and, you know, believe is for the common good, I'm willing to work with those people. But
so not the Sudanese, you know, government per se.
But yeah, you know, I make those decisions on a case by case basis. And
so a Bangladeshi death squad, not so much.
No, as long as it's not trying to hurt people.
Yeah.
You know, I'll give you an example. There was I spoke at DEF CON this year on some car hacking stuff, and a firefighter came up to me afterwards and said, you know, they would love to use the Open Sesame, basically garage hacking stuff, to break into buildings when there's a fire, so they don't, or like homes when there's a fire, so they don't have to break down the door to try to go in and, like, save someone. You know, if that's legitimate and it's just for that use, like, I would be happy to, you know, help them. I don't think those guys are gonna exploit it, and you can potentially lock it down so that they can't, you know, only under certain conditions would they be able to use it. It would log it, perhaps it would even log it publicly, so they can say, you know, every time they use it, this is where it was used at this time, at this address. And, you know, at least there would be some sort of public log of what's happening.
Yeah. It's funny when you think about all sorts of technologies like that, like even the taser, you know, and the guys who did the taser, they've built some really interesting features in it. Like it sprays confetti with a serial number all over the scene. Right.
Oh,
and the guys who founded that, I mean, they wanted to create an organization that made non-lethal weapons in order to save lives. I don't think they probably foresaw at the time that cops were going to use it just to torture people with, which is not the greatest. Now look, some people say a lot of this hardware hacking stuff, you know, they write it off as junk hacking. Then there's the opposing point of view. I mean, I had Balint Seba on the show some time ago talking about wireless hacking. It was a fantastic interview. I mean, I love watching that guy give con talks because he's like, you know, he's like a kid in a candy store with his antennas and stuff. Yeah, he's fantastic. And it really seemed to me that what's happened with the advent of things like Raspberry Pi, with things like software-defined radio, is that it's opening up a new frontier in terms of tinkering and hacking. I mean, where do you land on this? I'd imagine you'd be very much more on the Balint side than the writing it off as junk hacking side, right?
Oh, I mean, I think that's ridiculous. I mean, most people who have garages expect that to be protection. You know, insurance providers charge you less if you have a garage that's closed, right? Because you have a higher level of protection of protecting your stuff than if you don't. I mean, it's just like you wouldn't want to put a key on your, you know, that's why we have keys for our doors. Sure, they're not all the most effective, but they are somewhat effective. And I think anyone in security knows it's all about layers of security, right? There's not like one thing secures us all. It's about how can we have multiple layers that will protect us in multiple ways.
I guess the reason I'm asking this is because I'm wondering what you think the impact of the work that you're doing is, right? There's some people who will say, well, it's going to be ignored because the manufacturers, you know, car manufacturers don't get it, and people who make garage door motors don't get it, so nothing's going to change, so bah, what's the point, right? But, you know, I can I like to take the more optimistic view here and think that companies like GM, you know, particularly the larger organizations, will be more receptive. Like, have they been receptive? Have you dealt with them on this stuff?
Yeah, so, you know, when I did the OnStar attack, which it attacked OnStar from GM and demonstrated a flaw within their mobile, their iOS software that would allow me to, you know, locate a GM car, unlock it, and even remote start it if I've been able to if I've been able to pick up the credentials whenever a user opened the app up just once. You know, within 2 days of that hitting press, they resolved the issue. I found the same issue was prevalent in BMW, Mercedes-Benz, and Chrysler. I believe all of them have resolved the issue within a few weeks as well. So I think, yes, there are changes. And as I've talked to some of the cybersecurity divisions in these companies, they've also started to, you know, make it apparent to me that they're trying to open it up and make it easier for researchers such as myself and others to actually reach out to them and let them know of these existing flaws and ways to improve. So I think that's good. You know, I think it's unfortunate that there are so many issues, and I think we're going to start finding so many issues in these areas. But I mean, this is not, you know, I guess that junk hacking. I mean, if there's, dude, I don't want my car to get broken into. Yeah. I have expensive stuff. Well, I have thousands of dollars of equipment in my car virtually at all times. Right.
Mm. There's the other factor here, which is the refresh cycle on a typical car is not 2 years like an Android handset, right? So there's a tendency in the security discipline to regard things that are legacy as like being uninteresting, but there's plenty of 7-year-old cars on the road.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to think about who is this interesting to. And obviously, I think criminal organizations is very interesting to. This is not the first time a car has been broken into, right? This happens all the time. Mm. You know, car theft is a huge issue. That's why Immobilizer were invented. If breaking into cars wasn't an issue, they would have never spent all that time and research developing Immobilizers. Mm. Now that Immobilizer is getting hacked, we obviously continue to do more research and do more work and find how do we secure against that? How do we have more efficient algorithms? For example, there's the Volkswagen Megamos. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that properly, but that was released. You know, it's exploited more than 2 years ago and only finally released. Were some of the details.
Let me ask you, what are you actually going to be focusing on in the future? Because we've seen you move through, you know, sort of software stuff. You've moved into hardware. You've been focusing on automotive. Are there other areas that you're going to be opening up into?
Part of the automotive stuff that I've been looking at has partially been radio. So I think radio has been interesting to me as well. I'm still kind of a noob in radio, but I'm trying to learn that area. Yeah, another thing I've been doing is I started a YouTube channel this year called Applied Hacking, where I'm going down my process of how I hack something, really from start to finish, like how I even think to, yeah, just like how I open a device up or look at software and then how I go down the entire process from, you know, reverse engineering, hacking, developing software, hardware to exploit it, and then packaging it all up. I'd say, one thing I'm actually having fun is really teaching that, or at least, you know, trying to teach that process in those videos and write-ups. So I like to do more of that. So I might actually, you know, I might be doing some junk hacking in some areas where, you know, the thing I'm hacking is not, you know, not that interesting or doesn't actually affect someone's security, but the methods and techniques are the most cutting edge, most up-to-date, you know, highest quality that you would find in actually hacking. And you could take that and move it from some piece of junk to a real, you know, a real system that could be really interesting. But I'd say the areas I'm interested in right now, I'm going to get back into RFID a little bit. I did some development with Proxmark and released a lot of code for that several years ago. I might get back and jump into RFID again. Bluetooth is some stuff I've been looking at recently.
Yeah, look, I've been waiting for someone to have a proper crack at Bluetooth because, and it's something we've mentioned on the show a few times. If you tie the Bluetooth stuff to the automotive stuff, things get really interesting because everyone was talking about the Chrysler hack, like, oh, who cares? Like, not all cars are online. But if you consider the fact that everyone's cell phone pairs through Bluetooth with the head unit for hands-free calling, that means that, like, you know, 80% of cars made in the last few years or made since 2007 are actually connected to the internet. You know, 80% of the time that there's a driver in that car, they are paired up and they are connected to a cellular data network. So do you think it's do you think we could see an attack that would go to the driver's cell phone through the Bluetooth stack into the head unit and then onto the CAN bus? Because that's what I'm thinking is the cool one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in 2010, so one of the first real works in car hacking was a paper in 2010 from, I believe it's UCSD and maybe an additional school on car hacking. And one of the things they were exploiting was Bluetooth, right? They're exploiting like firmware through the CD player.
And I remember Bluetooth. That one, yeah.
So I think that like kicked off this whole area. I think that's pretty cool. And yeah, I think, you know, if we just start paying attention, you know, Charlie Millen and Chris Valsek have also kicked it off again. And I think like just opened up a lot of people's eyes in the area of car hacking and will probably now bring in a lot more attention to these areas. And I know the stuff I'm looking at is like I'm personally just scratching the surface. So I think there's so many areas to look at in these cars because they do so much and they're very cool. Like I love all the features that they're implementing. And I mean, I know for a fact, because they're new to it, there's going to be a number of holes.
Well, and you can imagine too that the Bluetooth, there's going to be like three Bluetooth stacks among 15 car manufacturers, right? They're all going to be licensing this stuff. So you find a bug in one, you find a bug in many.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So do you think that is actually a feasible attack? You could actually, if you own someone's cell phone, you could probably punch through the Bluetooth stack on the head unit and then off you go from there?
I wouldn't be surprised if you found an attack where you didn't even need to own someone's cell phone, that you might be able to attack the Bluetooth stack on the system, on the car itself, right? On the infotainment system, for example.
Just by being close to it when it's powered up.
Just by being, wireless proximity.
Yeah. That's terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. Super exciting.
So for you, it's you're going to push on. You're going to be looking at more automotive stuff. You're going to be looking at Bluetooth stuff, pushing on into RFID. Have you got anything major coming up anytime soon?
I'm not sure. I have a couple.
I just
things.
Saw a smile. I should explain to people that we're doing this interview with video turned on Skype. And just then before you answered, there was a bit of a grin there. So there is something, isn't there?
I hope so. I mean, I have a laundry list of things I'm working on. I'm very 99% of the 90% of those will never come to fruition or never be interesting enough for me to want to release publicly. But I'm hoping to find one or two cool things soon. I'd love to put out a couple more at least one or two more projects this year. But we'll see.
All right. Well, Sammy Kemkar, thank you very much for joining us on the program to talk about your history as a dangerous criminal and all of your research over the last decade. It's been fascinating to have you on the program, and I hope we can do it again.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Sammy Kemkar there. We spoke for about an hour in total, and I got to say, he's a conspicuously nice dude. So well done, Sammy. Okay, it is on to this week's sponsor interview now. Tenable Network Security is paying the bills this week, as they do every 4 weeks and have done for years. So big thanks to them for that. Tenable makes vulnerability scanning software, SIEM gear, all sorts of stuff. Do head over to tenable.com to check out what they get up to. And this week we are chatting with Tenable strategist Chris Thomas, who's probably better known by his handle, Space Rogue. Space Rogue is a former Loft member. They were, of course, the Boston hacking crew that spat out companies like AtStake and Veracode, and public figures like Peter Mudge Zatko of DARPA and CyberUL fame. So Space Rogue's been around computer security for a long time, and he joined me to discuss the great awakening that seems to be happening in the mainstream media, both in terms of news and entertainment, with breaches like Ashley Madison, and television shows like the USA Network's Excellent Mr. Robot. Is 2015 the year that computer security finally became a well-understood and appreciated discipline? Here's what he had to say.
Basically, it reminds me of Linux on the desktop. This is the year. It's going to happen. But it is increasing. It definitely different than it was a few years ago. You do have a larger number of people waking up and smelling the roses, if you will, and seeing the cyber around them. But at the same time, for example, in the wake of this, all the automotive hacking that's been going on, you have the big issue with Jeep. You have the issue with the SMS messages controlling a Corvette, and all these other hacks that have been published. You have Land Rover issuing a large a media buy advertising thing where you can control your Land Rover from your smartphone. And it's just interesting that on the one side you have car hack, oh my God, everything good is going to die. And you have Land Rover marketing that you can control your phone from an app.
My favorite headline, I think, of my entire career was a Fox News headline which said, patch your Jeep now before hackers kill you, which I really thought was one of those signs of the times things. But I mean, it's funny that you mentioned those two point counterpoints, right? So you've got the Miller and Valisak research into the Jeep stuff. And as you say, there's these big media buyers going, hey, you know, you can control your car from your smartphone. This has always been the problem, hasn't it? The race to secure versus the race for features and getting the latest whiz-bang stuff out into the market. So as much as security is becoming the go-to topic of 2015, it seems not as much has been learned as we would have liked, because we're still seeing this race and we know what's going to win. It's going to be the features.
Nothing has been learned.
Yeah.
I mean, we were talking the same thing that we've been talking about 20 years ago, right? I mean, we're talking about, you know, default passwords on systems. We're talking about no passwords on systems. We're talking about people who don't know what's on their network or what they're securing. These are all basic fundamental security things that the lessons have already been learned, but we're making the same mistakes over and over again. As each new vertical jumps into the, quote, cyber arena, they're making the same mistakes that everybody before them make.
So what do you think? Okay, so Charlie Miller and Chris Valisak get hired by Uber, and it made the Sydney Morning Herald here in Australia. I'm just scrolling through front page. This is something that would only happen in 2015. What do you think of that type of reporting? Because it's my feeling that when these guys are being lauded as sort of, you know, star hires for one of the world's hottest companies, and that's making the press in every corner of the globe in the mainstream press, this has got to be a good thing for the industry. It feels like we're finally getting some love.
Yeah, I mean, in Chris and Charlie and Chris's case, obviously they made the big press of their hire because they had the previous press of Jeep's going to kill you, right? Mm. And if they didn't get that press, they wouldn't have got the press when they got hired by Uber. Is this good for the industry? It's definitely good. It raises awareness among the general population that, you know, cyber, I'm going to use the air quotes.
Well, you already used raises awareness. What's next? Low-hanging fruit?
I love low-hanging fruit.
Raising the bar? We've got to raise the bar a bit. InfoSec, yeah, I mean, bullshit bingo.
It raises the bar. It raises awareness. It's the low-hanging fruit. Is that good for the industry? Maybe. I don't know. I think that yet to be seen. It's definitely going to hopefully increase the salaries of all of us. So maybe we'll get a little more money. I don't know what that's going to actually do to make people and things more secure in the long term.
Well, see, I wonder about this, right? Because we've got this tandem push at the moment. We're seeing things like the OPM hack happened. No one gave a shit, right? In the mainstream press. Like, it raised a bit of, it spooked a few people in DC. But along comes the Ashley Madison hack. And all of a sudden, people like me, anyone who can intelligently just speak about InfoSec, is getting hit by media bookers, right? To come onto the news to talk about it. So we've got the real world push of major data breaches. People are getting spooked by car hacks and things like that. But we're also seeing a push in popular culture. And I'm particularly interested in your thoughts on this because, you know, being one of the early Loft guys, right, you guys were sort of the template for what was considered a group of hackers. You were the sort of pop culture, this is what hackers are like. But now we're seeing portrayals, accurate portrayals, leak into art. And I'm thinking in particular of Mr. Robot, which I know you have seen. What do you think of it? It seems like an amazing portrayal, and it's catching on. People are into this show.
I mean, Mr. Robot is interesting on a large number of different levels. The tech, I mean, I was recently quoted before Mr. Robot came out of saying that the last time Hollywood got the tech and the story light right was Sneakers, right? Sneakers, they really married the technology and the storyline together, and it came out really great. Usually one of them or the other one is great. Either the story's great or the tech is great. They don't get them together. Mr. Robot, not only does it get the tech right, not only is there an engaging storyline that's really interesting to watch, but the character,
yeah,
right? The character Elliot has so many stereotypical hacker traits in him as one person. Like, I watched him as a character. I was like, oh, yeah, I do that.
I watched him and I'm like, I know that guy.
Yeah, I totally know this guy. He goes to all the same cons, right?
Yeah.
You know, I've hung out with him. I've had beers with this guy. He is a hacker guy from the hacker culture. And the fact that they were able to make that character so accurate to me is really speaks volumes to the producers of the show. Unfortunately, it's one show.
It is, but you got to think, right? This is the first time it's been done right. Now, on the flip side of that is CSI Cyber, right? Which I know is a pet hate of yours. This is the most ridiculous bullshit show in the world. Could I have a few choice words of your assessment of CSI Cyber?
Well, my choice words for CSI Cyber aren't really limited to CSI Cyber, but the entire CSI genre.
Mm.
The first three seasons of the original CSI were actually good, engaging, entertaining television. I have no idea if the technology they showed on the original CSI was actually accurate or not.
It didn't need to be. It was fun.
It didn't need to be, but it was believable, right?
Yeah.
And it sort of made sense. Even the computer stuff they were doing in CSI, the original 10 years ago, was believable, right? Now, none of it's believable. And the time ratios, that's the biggest thing that gets me on the CSI series, is that they solve the case in 24 hours. And they do all this cyber forensics investigation stuff that should take weeks, and they do it in a day, and they catch the bad guy. But, you know, that's Hollywood for you.
Well, and the thing is, right, I want to contrast these two programs, right? Because CSI Cyber, their idea of the stereotypical hacker, right, is like a chubby dude with a beard who's a bit of a slob, do you know what I mean, and kind of socially dysfunctional in a wacky way, right? Which is, you know, as we know, that is not a typical hacker. It's not some jolly nerd, right? You know, and we've got Mr. Robot, where it's kind of like this, you know, this guy loves to play mind games. He does morphine and loves owning shit, you know, and it's the contrast is night and day. And yet what we're seeing is, you know, among sort of connoisseurs of fine drama, Mr. Robot is the talk of the town. So I wonder if it's going to, you know, I wonder if we're going to see more accurate portrayals of this sort of hacking discipline in the media.
I hope so. There was a recent movie that came out, I forget the name of it now, that Kevin Poulsen was an advisor on, that got the tech right. But the storyline was total crap and the acting was bad and the characters were...
Was that Black Hat?
Black Hat, yes.
Yeah, and I thought the same thing, right? The tech was accurate, but it was boring.
Yeah, it's like, and again, they compressed the time scales way too much.
Mm.
So I think hopefully we'll see additional stories like Mr. Robot come out, one, because they're fun to watch, and I think maybe that because of the success of Mr. Robot, you will see producers and directors saying, well, gee, if I want to be as successful as that show, I need to make sure I get my tech right, right?
Yeah.
So they'll have accurate people on set to advise them and give them the correct information.
But see, what I love about this scenario, right, is the main character in this show, he's a pen tester or slash admin who works for a security company who does black hatty stuff on the side, right? And we all know people like that, right? We don't want to admit it, but we do. So I'm just wondering, now that we're seeing sort of more accurate characterizations and now that we're seeing people from the industry and people who are good hackers actually saying to their friends, hey, you should watch this. This is what it's like. I wonder if we combine these two things, right, which is more news media about, you know, computer intrusions and computer hacking. We combine it with some fantastic artistic television shows and some pop culture portrayals that are making hacking cool. I wonder if this is actually enough to improve the influx of people into the industry. What do you think?
So Mr. Robot may be this generation's War Games. War Games, you know, is the classic story. Guy hacks into NORAD, almost starts World War III, et cetera, et cetera. But that movie was an inspiration to an entire generation of hackers.
So, I mean, could it actually inspire people?
I think it is. I think it will. I mean, because people are going to be like, oh, wow, I can own my neighbor, right? And that's where they're going to get started, and hopefully they don't get busted trying to do so. Well, that's where we all started, right? We were basically doing bad stuff before people knew it was bad.
Well, and before the cops had their shit together enough to actually figure out what you were doing, right?
Exactly. And then you realized, oh, that was bad. I probably shouldn't do that anymore.
Mm.
So yes, I'm hoping Mr. Robot does inspire the next generation. I hope they don't look at what Mr. Robot is doing on the show and try to emulate that in real life, because they will get busted. But because the cops have their shit together now, right?
Yeah.
Or at least more so than they did. But yeah, it definitely will be an inspiration to a large number of people, and we will see a new influx of people into the industry because of this show.
All right, Space Rogue, thank you very much for joining us to have a little bit of a chat about art and reality and the news cycle in 2015. We live in interesting times.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
That was Tenable's Chris Thomas there with a chat about security and culture. And that is it for this week's show. This week's feature track is by a Byron Bay band called Waxhead. So, yeah, get some surfer rock into you. I saw these guys a few weeks ago at the Stone and Wood Brewery, which is actually just around the corner from my house. And, they were actually really, really good. Their drummer in particular is awesome. And I've linked through to this track on SoundCloud. I hope you enjoy the track. It is called Home. But until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.